Well, brethren, if you look at the subject of spiritual leadership in the Bible, whether you're looking at ancient Israel in the Old Testament or the New Covenant Church in the New Testament, if you're studying the subject of spiritual leadership, you can't help but notice it's a very male-dominated subject. You know, the majority of examples we find in both the Old and New Testament, you know, give us examples of men in designated leadership roles. However, there is a major exception to this, and that is the role of a prophetess. And what we're going to do today is take a look at this particular role and see what we can learn about this specific role that was exclusively filled by women. So if you'd like a title for this sermon, it's The Role of a Prophetess. Again, The Role of a Prophetess. Now, to start off with, I'd like to just establish a foundation, you know, that the majority of roles, of, you know, the major leadership roles that we think of, you know, for ancient Israel, were exclusively defined as roles for men. And to start off with, turn over to Numbers chapter 18, and we'll see here the establishment of the Levitical priesthood. I'm sure you're probably aware throughout ancient Israel's existence, you know, from the time they were established as a nation and left out of Egypt, you know, the priesthood was the major spiritual leadership of the nation throughout their history. And this was specifically defined as a role for men. So if you start reading here in Numbers chapter 18 in verse 1, it says, "Then Jehovah said to Aaron, 'You and your sons, your father's house with you, shall bear the iniquity related to the sanctuary, and you and your sons with you shall bear the iniquity associated with your priesthood. Also bring with you your brethren of the tribe of Levi, the tribe of your father, that they may be joined with you and serve you while you and your sons are with you before the tabernacle of witness.'" Notice it's specifically the sons of Aaron that we're talking about. In fact, if you kind of study the subject of the priesthood, oftentimes you'll see them kind of generally referred to as the sons of Aaron. But because you had to be a descendant of Aaron, and specifically a son in that lineage, to fill the role of a priest. And continue in verse 3. "They shall attend to your needs, all the needs of the tabernacle, but they shall not come near the articles of the sanctuary and the altar, lest they die, they and you also. They shall be joined with you and attend to the needs of the tabernacle of meeting, for all the work of the tabernacle, but an outsider shall not come near you. And you shall attend to the duties of the sanctuary and the duties of the altar, that there may be no more wrath on the children of Israel. Behold, I myself have taken your brethren, the Levites, from among the children of Israel, and they are a gift to you, given by Jehovah, to do the work of the tabernacle of meeting. Therefore, you and your sons with you shall attend to your priesthood for everything at the altar and behind the veil, and you shall serve. And I give your priesthood to you as a gift to your service, but the outsider who comes near shall be put to death." So you can see there that the criteria, it wasn't just being male, you had to specifically be a descendant of Aaron, but it was specifically the sons of Aaron. You know, so it was a exclusively male role. And this was true also of the role of kings. You know, as you know, for several hundred years of Israel's history, they didn't actually had kings. They had a system of judges. You know, but later they then demanded a king, and God basically gave this to them as a concession, you might say, because he kind of warned them up front. You know, this is not going to go well if you have a king like other nations. But they insisted upon that, so he gave them a king and warned them how that was going to go in the long run. But long before that ever happened, you know, God foresaw that was eventually just, it was just a matter of time before the people were going to demand a king. And he told Moses from the beginning what the criteria was, you know, that someone would need to meet to fulfill the role of a king. And if we take a look at this, we'll see, again, it was exclusively a male role. So to see that, turn over to Deuteronomy 17. Deuteronomy 17. And we'll start reading in verse 14. says, when you come to the land which Jehovah your God is giving you and possess it and dwell in it and say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me. You shall surely set a king over you whom Jehovah your God chooses, one from among your brethren. And you shall set as king over you, you may be set, you shall not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother. But he shall multiply horses for him, not multiply horses for himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. For Jehovah has said to you, you shall not return that way again. Neither shall he multiply wives for himself. I notice it's got to be exclusively a male role if you're saying he can't have multiple wives. And then continuing verse 17, let his heart turn away, nor shall he greatly multiply silver and gold for himself. Also it shall be when he sits on the throne of his kingdom that he shall write for himself a copy of this law in a book from the one before the priests, the Levites. And it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear Jehovah his God and be careful to observe all the words of this law and these statutes, and that his heart may not be lifted above his brethren, that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right hand or to the left, and that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel. Now, as you can see here, as I mentioned, the priesthood was primarily, that was a spiritual leadership role. The king was often typically more of a secular leadership role, you could say. But both of them, as we can see from the criteria, were exclusively male roles. But that doesn't mean that there weren't roles that were specifically for women. As I mentioned, the role of a prophetess, we're going to see a number of these, in fact, five of them, in fact, that are mentioned throughout Israel's history, where women are specifically mentioned as being in the role of a prophetess. So what we're going to do now is take a look at each of these women and see what these examples tell us about their roles. Now, the first individual mentioned in the role of a prophetess is Miriam. She's the sister of Moses and Aaron. Now, turn over to Exodus chapter 15, and we'll take a look at her example. Again, that's Exodus chapter 15. And we'll see here that Miriam is only mentioned in the Bible a couple of times. So we don't have a whole lot of information, or really even a whole lot of information in regards to her role. But we're going to see what we can glean from her example here. Now, what we're going to pick up here is in Exodus chapter 15. We'll start reading in verse 20, but just to set the context here. By chapter 15, the Israelites have come out of Egypt. They've made their journey out of Egypt. They've crossed the Red Sea. They've just been through the event where, Pharaoh's army is drowned in the Red Sea. Now they're out of Egyptian territory, and they're having a celebration. As you can imagine, they're all very happy because, now they're out of Egypt. They're completely out of Egyptian territory. They're no longer being chased by an army with the threat of death, and they're rather happy. And they're having a celebration. Now, the first part of chapter 15, you can see, is what's called the Song of Moses, and Moses is kind of leading the people here in this song of celebration. But to pick up here in verse 20, this is where it tells us about Miriam, and it tells us that she is a prophetess. So, and again in verse 20, then Miriam the prophetess, the sister of Aaron, took the timbrel in her hand, and all the women went out after her with the timbrels and with dances. And Miriam answered them, sing to Jehovah, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and its rider he has thrown into the sea. So you can see it's a song of celebration here. Now, it doesn't really tell us much else about Miriam's role and what exactly, what all that she did in fulfilling the role of a prophetess. What it tells us here, it's obviously a picture of her being a leader among the women, of the Israelites. It doesn't really tell us much else. Did she ever prophesy and, foretell the future or, reveal God's will? It doesn't really tell us if she ever did. We'll see when we look at some of the following examples of other women, there are examples of them, communicating God's will and such. But with Miriam, again, we only have limited information. However, there is another example that does give us some insight into her role. Let's turn over to Numbers chapter 12. What we're going to see here is kind of how to place her role in terms of, you know, Moses and Aaron's role, you might say, and in terms of how all this compared. Because what we're going to see here in Numbers 12 is a story where Miriam and Aaron are basically criticizing Moses. You know, they're basically kind of getting on his case, you know, and judging his role in a marriage that he had, and they get chastised from God for doing this. But we can see from, you know, the example of what takes place here and the correction that God gives them, that they're basically trying to get, kind of equate themselves with Moses' role, and they get slapped down for this. But what we're going to notice here is Miriam in particular, you know, takes the brunt of the punishment. And we're going to kind of put together after we read through this why that might be the case, because it kind of tells us some details about her role. This is in Numbers chapter 12 in verse 1. And then Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Ethiopian woman whom he had married. For he had married an Ethiopian woman. And they said, "Has Jehovah indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also?" And Jehovah heard it. Now, first of all, let's notice what they state here in verse 2 is actually true. You know, because they're both saying, does God only work through Moses? Doesn't he work through us as well? Well, we've just seen that, you know, Miriam is a prophetess. It directly states that in the Bible. Aaron is also the high priest. You know, we just saw earlier that the priesthood is his lineage, where Aaron is the first high priest. So does God work through the two of them? Well, yes, obviously. You know, they both have, you know, designated roles that the Bible describes. But let's just notice here how they kind of overstep their bounds in those roles. Let's pick up in verse 3. "Now the man Moses was very humble, more than all the men who were on the face of the earth. And suddenly Jehovah said to Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, 'Come out, you three, to the tabernacle of meeting.' So the three came out. And then Jehovah came down in the pillar of cloud and stood in the door of the tabernacle and called Aaron and Miriam, and they both went forward. And then he said, 'Hear now my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, Jehovah, make myself known to him in a vision, and I speak to him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses, for he is faithful in all my house. I speak to him face to face, even plainly and not in dark sayings, and he sees the form of Jehovah. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses?'" Notice they're trying to equate themselves as equals with Moses' role, and God doesn't see it that way. And he slaps them down for this and points out the differences here. Now, just as a side note here, notice he mentions here he speaks face to face with Moses. Now, oftentimes we interpret that statement as the way we use the phrase in English. When we say we're talking face to face with someone, we mean we're looking into the whites of each other's eyes. Now, if you kind of read through Moses' writings here, particularly in the book of Exodus, you'll see obviously that's not what was intended here, you know, because there's a point at Mount Sinai where Moses asks, you know, "Can I see your face?" And God tells him, "No, you can't see my face and live to tell the story." You know, that's not a possibility, you know, because that's not really what the Hebrew expression means there. It's translated as face to face. It's more about direct communication. But I won't go into all the details of that today, but if you have any questions about that, there's a study paper on my website called Seeing and Hearing God. If you're watching this on YouTube, if you just look at the link below this video, you'll see a link that takes you straight to my website, searchingthescriptures.org, and you'll see a study paper there that covers that in detail. But just pick up here in verse 9, and let's notice that Miriam takes the brunt of the punishment, you know, for because both her and Aaron have obviously misbehaved here because God called them both out. But notice who gets the brunt of the punishment here. In verse 9, "So the anger of Jehovah was aroused against them, and he departed. And when the cloud departed from above the tabernacle, suddenly Miriam became leprous as white as snow. And Aaron turned towards Miriam, and there she was, a leper. So Aaron says to Moses, "Oh my Lord, please do not lay this sin on us, in which we have done foolishly, in which we have sinned. Please do not let her be as one dead, whose flesh is half consumed when he comes out of his mother's womb." So Moses cried out to Jehovah, saying, "Please hear her, heal her, O God, I pray." Then Jehovah said to Moses, "If her father had but spit in her face, would she not have be shamed 7 days? Let her be shut out of the camp 7 days, and after that she may be received again." So Miriam was shut out of the camp 7 days, and the people did not journey until Miriam was brought in again. And afterwards the people moved from Hazeroth and camped in the wilderness of Paran. So notice here, Miriam and Aaron both are obviously involved in misbehaving. They both get called out. But Miriam is the one who gets struck with Moses and who gets ostracized for 7 days. Well, why does she get singled out in this regard? Now, again, we have to speculate a little bit here, but I think we can back this up from biblical example. As you notice here, you know, Miriam has a designated role as a prophetess, and Aaron has, you know, a role of being the high priest. But there's also a part of these roles, you know, that Aaron takes part in part of Moses' role in terms of the negative reaction when the Israelites are upset. You know, because just like most things in life, you know, roles, you know, come with an upside and a downside. You know, oftentimes we talk about rights and responsibilities go together. You know, that there's not just privileges and rights, there's also some, you know, the negative side. You know, there's the burden that comes with roles as well. Well, if you read through the examples in Moses' writings, you know, whenever the Israelites get upset, you know, they're oftentimes venting their frustrations at Moses. There are times that they're literally picking up stones and ready to kill him. You know, well, you'll see oftentimes Aaron is included in that. You know, he gets the brunt of the negative reactions as well. You never see Miriam associated with that. You know, she's never mentioned in the context of everyone, you know, picking up stones and they're ready to stone Miriam. You also never see her demanding her equality, you know, in that sense as well. So she wants to have the say here, you know, and be able to criticize Moses, but she's not taking the flack of the people that comes with his role. You know, she's the one overstepping her bounds the most, is why I think she was kind of targeted for the most punishment. But now, as I mentioned, there are multiple women that are mentioned in the Bible, you know, specifically designated as prophetesses. Now, the next one we're going to look at is Deborah. And we'll find Deborah in Judges chapter 4. You'll turn over to Judges chapter 4. Now, we'll see not only is Deborah, you know, described as a prophetess, she's also described as a judge. You know, and that's, you know, she's very much an exception to the rule in that regard as well. And the reason I say that is because if you look at all the judges listed out in the, you know, throughout the book of Judges and even into 1 Samuel, you know, there's over a dozen individuals that are, you know, specifically described as judges, but Deborah is the only one that's a woman. All of the rest of them are a man. You know, so she's very unique in that way as well. But just to notice her role here, let's read through Judges chapter 4, and we'll start here in verse 1. And when Ehud was dead, the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of Jehovah. So Jehovah sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. And the commander of his army was Sisera, who dwelt in Hasareth Hagim. And the children of Israel cried out to Jehovah, for Jabin had 900 chariots of iron. And for 20 years he harshly oppressed the children of Israel. Now Deborah, a prophetess, though the wife of Lippadoth, was judging Israel at that time. Now notice that she's described as a prophetess and a judge. And again, she's very much an exception to the rule when it comes to being a judge, because all the rest of them were men. In verse 5, And she would sit under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the mountains of Ephraim. And the children of Israel came up to her for judgment. And then she went and called for Barak, son of Abinoam, from Kadesh in Naphtali, and said to him, "Has not Jehovah, God of Israel, commanded, saying, go and deploy troops at Mount Tabor, and take with you 10,000 men of the sons of Naphtali and the sons of Zebulun? And against you I will deploy Sisera, commander of Jabin's army, and his chariots and his multitude at the river Kishon, and I will deliver him into your hand." And now notice Deborah has just told him, God's already telling you how the movie's going to end. You're going to win. But let's notice Barak's response to this. And Barak said to her, if you will go with me, then I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go. That is, he's timid. He's afraid of going without her. In verse 9. So she said, I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, there will be no glory for you in the journey you are taking. For Jehovah will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman. And then Deborah arose and went with Barak to Kadesh. Now, as you notice here, she's basically telling him, there's going to be consequences for this, for you, because you didn't have the courage to just go into battle, and you're insisting that a woman go with you. Now, again, the reason I mention this, and we won't take the time to turn to Deuteronomy 20, but if you read Deuteronomy 20, it gives the instructions God gave to Israel for going to war and kind of what the rules were associated with it. And you'll see he specifically designates men as the ones who were supposed to go into battle and fight the wars, and kind of deal with the horror of war and, risk being killed and maimed and such. Because again, as I mentioned, you always have to look at it from a balanced perspective and realize it's not just about rights and roles and being able to be in charge. It's also the downside as well. The majority of leadership roles were men, but men were also the ones that got sent into battle and had to risk their lives, potentially be killed or maimed in the battle. God never describes, women being commanded to go into battle. They sat back and were protected. And we'll see in this case, Barak, even though Deborah has just told him, God says you're going to win, he doesn't have the face to do that, and he wants, Deborah to come with him. And that's why she's saying, well, there's going to be a consequence. You're going to lose the glory of being able to kind of kill the leader of the opposing army. And we'll see here as we read through the rest of the chapter, he's actually killed by a woman. And pick up in verse 10. And Barak called Zebulun and Naphtali to Kadesh. And he went up with 10,000 men under his command, and Deborah went up with him. Now Heber the Kenite of the children of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, had separated himself from the Kenites and pitched his tent near the Taberinth tree at Zaman, which is beside Kadesh. And they reported to Sisera that Barak the son of Abinoam had gone up to Mount Tabor. So Sisera gathered together all the chariots, 900 chariots of iron, and all the people who were with him, and from Harosheth Hagoyim to the river Kishon. And then Deborah said to Barak, "Up, for this is the day in which Jehovah has delivered Sisera into your hand. And has not Jehovah gone out before you?" So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him. And Jehovah routed Sisera and all of his chariots and all of his army with the edge of the sword before Barak. And Sisera alighted from his chariot and fled away on foot. But Barak pursued the chariots and the army as far as Horshath Hagoyim, and all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword. Not a man was left. However, Sisera had fled away on foot to the tent of Jael, wife of Heber the Kenite, and there was peace between Jabin and King Hazor and the house of Heber the Kenite. And Jael went up to meet Sisera and said to him, "Turn aside, my lord, turn aside to me, do not fear." And when he had turned aside with her into the tent, she covered him with a blanket. And then he said to her, please give me a little water to drink, for I am thirsty. So he opened a jug of milk and gave him a drink and covered him. And then he said to her, stand at the door of the tent, and if any man comes and inquires of you and says, is there any man there, you shall say no. And then Jael, Heber's wife, took a tent peg and took a hammer in her hand and went softly to him and drove the tent peg into his temple and went down to the ground, and he was fast asleep and weary, so he died. You know, as Deborah told him, you know, you're going to lose the glory of, you know, killing the commander of the opposing army. He's going to be delivered in the hands of a woman. Well, this is what she was referring to. And verse 22, and then as Barak pursued Sisera, Jael came out to meet him and said to him, come, I will show you the man whom you seek. And when he went into to the tent, there lay Sisera dead with a peg in the temple. So on that day, God to subdue Jabin, king of Canaan, in the presence of the children of Israel. And the hand of the children of Israel grew stronger and stronger against Jabin, king of Canaan, until they had destroyed Jabin, king of Canaan. So you can see here, in Deborah's example, it gives us a lot more detail than it does in regards to Miriam. And we can see here that, you know, as a prophetess, Deborah, you know, communicates God's will, just like, you know, many of the prophets that are described throughout the Bible, where they're speaking on behalf of God and communicating to other individuals. You know, here's the message that God has given to me to deliver. Well, Deborah does that. You know, she fulfills this. She even again served as a judge of Israel, you know, and in a role that was typically fulfilled the majority of the time by men. You know, but possibly one of the reasons she's in that role, we saw with Barak, you know, the timidness that he had. He wouldn't go into battle without a woman with him. Wasn't really a courageous thing for him to do, and in line with, you know, God's instructions for how Israel was supposed to do battle. You know, possibly the weakness of men at the time is why God, you know, placed a woman in this role. But either way, God clearly inspired, you know, the role of Deborah and used her in this way. Now, the next person that we're going to look at is Huldah, and she's actually in the time of the kings. So let's turn over to 2 Kings, 2 Kings chapter 22. And this is another example where it gives us, you know, a lot more detail as to the role that she fulfilled as a prophetess. Because we're going to see Huldah, you know, similar to Deborah, you know, just like the prophets, you know, we'd speak, you know, here is God's will, and here's what he has sent me to communicate to you. She does that very thing as well. Now, just to get the full context of her story, we're going to start in 2 Kings 22 and in verse 3. Now it came to pass in the 18th year of King Josiah that the king sent Shaphan, the scribe, the son of Azaliah, and the son of Meshullam, to the house of Jehovah, saying, go up to Hilkiah, the high priest, that he may count the money which has been brought into the house of Jehovah, which the doorkeepers have gathered from the people. And let them deliver it into the hand of those doing the work who are the overseers in the house of Jehovah. And let them give it to those who are in the house of Jehovah, doing the work to repair the damages of the house, and to the carpenters and builders and masons, and to buy timber and hewn stone to repair the house. Now, obviously, you know, that the house that they're referring to here is the temple. Now, that's the house of the Lord, is that this is God's temple that they're referring to here. In verse 7, however, there need be no accounting made to them of the money delivered into their hand, because they deal faithfully. Then Hilkiah the high priest said to Shaphan the scribe, I have found a book of the law in the house of Jehovah. And Hilkiah gave the book to Shaphan, and he read it. Now, that's a very telling statement there. Now, think about this. This is the high priest, you know, communicating, we found the book of the law. What were they using prior to that? I mean, this kind of tells you the state of the nation, you know, and even the spiritual leadership. You know, the high priest is supposed to be a significant spiritual leader here. And he's saying to the king's messenger here, you know, go tell the king. It's kind of like today saying, we found a Bible. Maybe we should actually read it. You know, that's literally what's going on here. Where the high priest in God's temple is saying, you know, we were looking, you know, basically reconciling all the money here and taking care of the money, and we happened to find a copy of the book of the law. I mean, this tells you the state of the spiritual leadership of what was going on at that time. And in verse 9, so Shaphan, the scribe, went to the king, bringing the king word, saying, your servants have gathered the money that was found in the house and have delivered into the house those who do the work and oversee the house of Jehovah. Then Shaphan, the scribe, showed the king, saying, Hilkiah the priest has given me a book. And Shaphan read it before the king. And this is also kind of an interesting tale of their priorities here. You know, they were collecting the money and distributing the money. That seemed to be important to them. And along the way, oh, we found God's word. We found the book of the law. I mean, that would be like today saying, you know, we're at church and we're taking care of the money and we just stumbled on a copy of the Bible. Maybe we should actually read it. You know, that's literally what's happening here. In verse 11, now it happened when the king heard the words of the book of the law that he tore his clothes. And then the king commanded Hilkiah the priest, Ahiakim the son of Shaphan, Achbor the son of Micaiah, and Shaphan the scribe, and Isaiah the servant of king, saying, go inquire of Jehovah for me, for the people and for all of Judah concerning the words of this book that he has found. For great is the wrath of Jehovah that is aroused against us, because our fathers have not obeyed the words of this book to do according to all that is written concerning us. You know, not only have they not obeyed it, they've completely ignored the book. I mean, to the point that it was noteworthy to say, we found a copy of it. And verse 14, so Hilkiah the priest, Ahiakim, Acher, Shaphan, Isaiah, went to Huldah the prophetess, and the wife of Shalem, the son of Tikva, the son of Harshas, keeper of the wardrobe. She dwelt in Jerusalem in the second quarter, and they spoke with her. Then she said to them, thus says Jehovah God of Israel, tell the man who sent you to me, thus says Jehovah. Notice she's speaking on behalf of God. She's communicating his will, just like the prophets did. Behold, I will bring calamity on this place and all its inhabitants and all the words of the book which the king Judah has read, because they have forsaken me and burned incense and other gods, that they might provoke me to anger with all the works of their hands. Therefore my wrath shall be aroused against this place and shall not be quenched. But the king of Judah, who sent you to inquire of Jehovah in this manner, you shall speak to him. Thus says Jehovah God of Israel, concerning the words which you have heard, because your heart was tender, and you humbled yourself before Jehovah, then you heard what I spoke against this place and against its inhabitants, that they could become a desolation and a curse, and you tore your clothes and wept before me. I also have heard you, says Jehovah. Surely, therefore, I will gather you to your fathers, and you shall be gathered to your grave in peace, and your eyes shall not see all the calamity which I will bring upon this place. So they brought the word to the king. So you can see here, Huldah is again functioning very much in the same way that we'd see as a prophet. You know, she's communicating God's will, giving the warning that you need to repent. You know, that you know you need to turn to God, or you know, communicating that God's going to just, you know, destroy the nation, send you into captivity. You know, she's just very much the same thing that we see, you know, that the prophet's doing. In fact, another interesting thing about her story is that Huldah and Jeremiah were contemporary with each other. Now, you don't see Jeremiah mentioned in her story, and you don't see her mentioned in Jeremiah's story. But if you kind of compare that the references of referring to, you know, being in Judah under King Josiah and the years associated with it, they were obviously contemporary and they overlapped with one another. Now, another example we need to look at is the example of Isaiah's wife. Now, turn over to Isaiah chapter 8. And this is the fourth lady we're going to take a look at. Now, in this particular case, it's debated as to whether, you know, Isaiah's wife here, you know, fulfilled the role, you know, of a prophetess, you know, similar to what we saw with like Deborah and Huldah, or if maybe she's referred to as a prophetess, you know, simply for being Isaiah's wife. And you'll see as we read this in the context why that's the case. Because we're not even given her name here. She's just very briefly mentioned. No real details are given, you know, about her or anything that she did. And the reference to calling her a prophetess is only in the context of her, you know, basically becoming pregnant and giving a son, you know, to Isaiah. You know, again, it's just very kind of a brief drive-by reference that there's there. So a lot of, you know, commentaries, and you'll see scholars kind of debate, well, did she fulfill the role of a prophetess in other ways? Or is that this term applied to her simply because, you know, that she's Isaiah's wife? You know, it's hard to know because, again, the Bible just doesn't really tell us much else about her. But just to read her account, let's notice here in Isaiah chapter 8 and verse 1. Moreover, Jehovah said to me, take a large scroll and write on it with a man's pen concerning Meher Shalal Hashbaz, and I will make for myself faithful witnesses to record Uriah the priest and Zechariah the son of Jerushimal. And then I went to the prophetess, and she conceived and bore a son. And then Jehovah said to me, call his name Meher Shalal Hashbaz. So you can see we're not given her name. She's referred to as a prophetess, but it's just in the context of she bore this son, and we're not told anything else about her. And just to finish the thought, continue on in verse 4. For before the child shall have knowledge to cry my father and my mother, the riches of Damascus and then in the spoil of Samaria will be taken away before the king of Assyria. So you can see it's just kind of what you might call a drive-by reference, you know, where she's just kind of briefly, you know, alluded to, referred to as a prophetess, and we're not told anything else. So it's debatable, was this a formal role that she fulfilled, or is she kind of referred to as a prophetess simply for being Isaiah's wife and bearing a son? It's really hard to tell because the Bible just doesn't tell us much else. Now, to look at the fifth example, this is actually recorded in the New Testament. But I think as we're going to see here, if we look at the timing, it really kind of fits more in an Old Covenant, you know, it's Israel context. But turn over to Luke chapter 2. And we'll see here a lady named Anna, who again is, you know, specifically referred to as a prophetess. And it tells us a little about, you know, how she functioned in this role. But we also need to pay attention to the timing of this role. Because again, as I mentioned, I mean, this is recorded in the book of Luke, which, as we all know, is obviously in the New Testament. But in terms of where this would fit, you know, for in terms of the divisions of the Old Covenant, you know, Old Covenant Israel versus the New Covenant Church, we would obviously have to place this more, you know, more appropriately connected with Old Covenant Israel. Because if you read through Luke chapter 2 here, what you'll see is this is in the timing of Christ just being born and just having been circumcised, you know, on the eighth day according to biblical command. Well, you know, John the Baptist is just a few months older, about, you know, approximately 6 months older than Christ is, you know, and as the New Testament tells us, you know, John kind of technically starts the ministry of Christ because he starts, you know, preparing the way for him and, you know, starts baptism and proclaiming that Christ is going to come, you know, and be the Savior for mankind. Well, at the time that we have this reference to Anna, both John the Baptist and Christ himself are less than a year old. I mean, they're infants. They're not even speaking yet, let alone having their own ministry. But just with that timing in mind, let's start reading Luke chapter 2 in verse 36. Now there was one Anna, a prophetess, a daughter of Phanuel, of the tribe of Asher. And she was of great age and had lived with a husband 7 years from her virginity. And this woman was a widow of about 84 years, who did not depart from the temple, but served God with fastings and prayers night and day. And coming in that instant, she gave thanks to the Lord and spoke of him to all those who looked for redemption in Jerusalem. So you can see that she obviously was sharing with others that she knew who Christ was, and that this child is going to be, the Savior of mankind. He's going to be the sacrifice for everyone. And again, we don't have much else described in terms of her role, but we obviously know, she's directly referred to as a prophetess. As we can see here, we've covered five different women, that are specifically mentioned as prophetesses. Now, again, we're not going to take a look at every woman that's referred to in the Bible as a false prophetess, because as I mentioned, they're, just like how men can be a true prophet or a false prophet, who took that title upon themselves and are not acting on behalf of God's instructions and such. Well, there were women who did the same thing. Human nature doesn't discriminate, but again, we'll briefly touch today on an example of a false prophet, but we're not going to look at all of them. But as we notice here, as I mentioned, even Anna, if we look at her role as a prophetess, really fits more in Old Covenant Israel as opposed to the New Covenant Church. Because if we look at the spiritual leadership roles that are laid out for the New Covenant Church, we don't have the role of a prophetess. This is, again, very specifically a male-dominated role because, again, we don't even have the role of the Levitical priesthood in the New Covenant Church because, the roles are very, very, very uniquely different because in ancient Israel, again, you had the priesthood, you had the high priest and the other priests that assisted him. A lot of their duties were animal sacrifices related, working specifically at the temple. Well, in the New Covenant Church, we don't have animal sacrifices. And again, we are the temple. We don't have to go to a temple to worship. So it's a totally different setup, and it has a different focus. But as we're going to see here, when we look at the spiritual roles of, the spiritual leadership in the New Covenant Church, again, we don't have a priesthood, and we have totally different roles that are articulated, but these roles are, again, very specifically defined as male roles. And to see that, turn over to Ephesians chapter 4. In Ephesians chapter 4, and we'll see here where Paul lists out the various roles of the New Covenant ministry. This is in Ephesians 4 and verse 11. So then he himself gave some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors and teachers, for the equipping of the saints, for the work of ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ, till we all come to the unity of faith and the knowledge of the Son of God, to a perfect man, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ, that we should no longer be children tossed to and fro, carried about with every wind of doctrine, by the trickery of men and the cunning of craftiness by which they lie in wait to deceive, but speaking the truth in love, may grow up in all things into him who is the head of Christ, for whom the whole body, joined in and knit together, for what every joint supplies according to the effective working, by which every part does its share, causes growth of the body to the edifying of itself in love. So you can see here we've had the various roles of the New Covenant ministry defined here. But if you'll notice, as it describes, kind of the purpose for all of this, it's very much in the context of teaching correct doctrine, is what it's focused on. And we're going to see here is when we look at where Paul, described the qualifications for these roles, it's specifically defined as male roles. In fact, the Bible also is going to show for us here in Paul's writings that formal teaching, you know, actually, you know, in services in a designated teaching role, you know, was something that was exclusively for men. Because Paul directly says this is not a role for women. He even gives us a reason why. But just to notice that, turn over to 1 Timothy chapter 3. This is 1 Timothy in chapter 3. And we'll start reading here in verse 1. We're going to see here the qualifications he lists out for someone being ordained into the ministry. It says, "This is a faithful saying. If a man desires the position of a bishop, he desires a good work." Now, as Paul states right up front, we're talking about roles for men. And this is, pick up in verse 2 now. "A bishop must be blameless, the husband of one wife." Again, that's a criteria obviously only a man's going to have, being the husband of one wife. "Temperate, sober-minded, of good behavior, hospitable, able to teach, not given to wine, not violent, not greedy for money, but gentle, not quarrelsome, not covetous. One who rules his own house well, having his children in submission with all reverence. For if a man does not know how to rule his own house, how will he take care of the church of God? Not a novice, lest being puffed up with pride, he fall into the same condemnation as the devil. Moreover, he must have a good testimony among those who are outside, lest he fall into the reproach and the snare of the devil." So as I mentioned, you can see here how, you know, Paul, from the very beginning of listing this criteria, says this is a role for men. And even as he describes it, you know, it becomes very obvious that's what he is, you know, defining this exclusively as a role for men. But again, as I mentioned, notice that one of the qualifications for this was being able to teach, because it is a teaching role. Well, just prior to where Paul, you know, defines these qualifications for us, he specifically tells us that formally teaching in services, you know, in a designated teaching role, is not a role for women. And just notice here at the latter part of chapter 2. So, you know, this is what Paul has addressed right before he addresses the roles of the ministry. This is in 1 Timothy 2 and verse 8. It says, "Therefore I desire that the men pray everywhere, lift up holy hands without wrath and doubting, and in like manner also that the women adorn themselves in modest apparel with propriety and moderation, not with braided hair or gold or pearls of costly clothing, but with which is proper for women professing godliness with good works. And let a woman learn in silence with all submission. And I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man, but to be in silence. For Adam was formed first, then Eve. And Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived fell into transgression. Nevertheless, she will be saved in childbearing if they continue in faith, love, holiness, and self-control." Now, notice here, he's speaking specifically of, again, a formal teaching role, because, again, the verse is right after this. What is he addressing? The roles of the ministry. You know, so that's obviously what he's referring to here, you know, being a formal teacher in services. He's not saying that women can't teach children, or they can't teach other women, or, you know, being in, you know, less formal roles in that regard. He's specifically referring to having authority over men, or, again, a formal teaching role in church is what he's referring to here. But now notice he also gives us a reason for why he said this. And this is in verse 13 and 14 here. He says, "For Adam was formed first, then Eve. And Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived fell into transgression." Now, what he's referring to here is, you know, the Genesis 3 story in the Garden of Eden. Now, again, this is a subject that gets, you know, our feminist mentality of our culture today just really riled up. You know, but let's just look at the reality of what Paul has stated here. He's saying that the reason that he's saying that a woman shouldn't teach is because, again, Eve was deceived, but Adam wasn't. Well, just look at the dynamics of what took place there. What Satan did in Genesis chapter 3, he played upon Eve's emotions. You know, he's basically, what Paul's getting at here is the fact that women by design and by, you know, God's in intent from the beginning, you know, was that women were to be more emotional. Well, and again, men are less emotional. Again, both of those come with an upside and a downside. But how did Satan play upon Eve? Very much the same way the feminist movement plays upon women to this day. He convinces her that God's trying to treat her out of equality. Because what does he say to her? You know, well, God knows if you eat of that fruit, you'll be just like him. You'll be equal with him. So God's trying to cheat you out of equality. He's trying to oppress you. But here, eat this fruit. It's empowering. It's the exact same sales pitch that we hear today. You're a victim. You're being cheated out of equality. And here's your empowerment. And it was a way to suck her in. You know, well, it worked. Well, he then used her to play upon the man's weaknesses, because again, both of them had their inherent weaknesses. But this is what Paul is referring to here as to why he's saying a woman shouldn't formally teach, you know, or have roles in the ministry. Again, it doesn't mean that women can't be valuable assets and have valuable insights, even into spiritual knowledge. We'll address that here in a minute. He's just saying specifically for the leadership roles, you know, in the New Covenant Church, says that is a role for men and not for women. Now before we go any further here, I'd like to just also clarify some common misunderstandings with the verse 15 here. It says, nevertheless, she shall be saved in childbearing if they continue in faith, love, and holiness with self-control. Now notice the words she and they. There, but because the understanding she is obvious if you just read the prior verses. It was referring to Eve specifically. You know, they is again referring more broadly, you know, to the women or you know, in general, or mankind in general. You know, because when it's saying that she shall be redeemed through childbearing, it's not that there's something magical about a woman having a child and that somehow is going to redeem her. Now, this is referring to, again, the Genesis 3 story. You know, well, there's a prophecy talking about how Christ is going to descend from Eve. You know, because Eve is the mother of all of mankind. You know, it descended from her, all of us that exist today and have existed, you know, throughout human history. You can trace our lineage back to Eve as our, you know, great, 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 great grandmother, you know, because everyone came from her. Well, this is referring to Christ being her descendant, you know, and that's how salvation would come to not only her, but to everyone, is what that verse is referring to here. But now, as I mentioned previously, you know, the Bible not only gives us, you know, these five women that it mentions specifically as prophetesses, it also tells us, you know, that there are women who are false prophetesses. You know, just like there are men, you know, who in the Bible described as being false prophets, there are women who are described as false prophetesses. And if we look at one example of this in Revelation chapter 2, this also kind of further backs up, you know, what we just saw here with Paul's instructions, and again in terms of, you know, formal teaching roles in the Church of God being specifically a male role. Now, notice here in Revelation 2. And we're going to look at verse 18 here. This is, you know, we're kind of breaking into the letters to the seven churches. And this is, again, specifically the letter to the church at Thyatira. But let's just notice a reference here. Starting in verse 18. And to the angel of the church of Thyatira write, these things says the Son of God, who has eyes like the flame of fire and his feet like fine brass. I know your works, love, service, faith, and your patience. As for your works, that the last are more than the first. Nevertheless, I have a few things against you, because you allow that woman Jezebel, who calls herself a prophetess, to teach and to beguile my servants to commit sexual immorality and to eat things sacrificed to idols. I notice it says she calls herself a prophetess. You know, Christ isn't saying she's a prophetess. He's saying she claims that title. You know, it's just like anyone who claims a title that God didn't give them. You know, she's fraudulent. But notice how he gives the criticism to the church. He says, you allow her to teach. In other words, you know, she obviously in this context, it's referring to a woman who's been given a formal teaching role. You know, and there was two issues here. It wasn't just that she was encouraging and trying to lead people into sin, that you allowed her to teach in the first place. You know, and again, this is not saying, again, that women can't have, you know, meaningful insights into the Bible. Again, we'll discuss that here in a moment. We're referring to, again, inherently the fact that what you know, John is recording here, quoting Christ himself, is backing up exactly what we read of Paul there in 1 Timothy, saying that a formal teaching role in services is not a role for women. Now, again, this is not something to somehow, you know, oppress or to put down women, you know, because oftentimes in our society today, you even talk about this subject and people get very riled up of, you know, you're being sexist and oppressing women. Well, the Bible has tons of examples of people overstepping their bounds. You know, we have false prophets, we have, you know, false ministers in the new church, in the New Testament that are described. There's even, if you look in the Old Testament, you know, there are examples of kings who then tried to not just be a king, try to take on the role of a priest, push themselves into the temple and try to give sacrifices. You know, some even got leprosy for doing this. You know, it wasn't just the issue of men versus women. It was individuals overstepping the role that God defined for them. Because even just take the role of like the priesthood, you know, because we covered earlier, you know, the priesthood was specifically a male role. It wasn't just a male role. They had to be the descendants of Aaron. They had to be the sons of Aaron. You know, in my last sermon, you know, I kind of covered the story of, you know, in the book of Kings, where, you know, the Israel and Judah, you know, separate and there's a division and they become, you know, separate nations. Well, one of the things we talked about, and I kind of highlighted at that point, when Jeroboam becomes king of, you know, the northern 10 tribes, he appoints people as priests who are not Levites. You know, and again, they were illegitimate priests, and this led the nation astray. And again, this isn't just a, you know, sexism issue of male versus women, you know, men versus women. It's the issue of people taking on roles that God didn't give them. You know, because again, you couldn't just be a priest just because you were a man. You had to be a son of Aaron. You know, it was a very exclusive thing because that's how God defined the roles. Well, again, he's defined divisions between some roles that are for men, some that are for women. Again, it's just respecting God's design is what we need to pay attention to here. Well, let's also address another subject that oftentimes gets confusing as well. Because if we look at here in 1 Corinthians 11, we'll see here another subject here where Paul is addressing the issue of, you know, kind of different roles between men and women and some of the inherent differences that God's instructed here. But it also uses the word prophesying. And sometimes people kind of scratch their head over this one as, you know, and use that as a basis to kind of challenge the role of whether we have prophetesses in the New Covenant church or not. So let's look at this particular subject. This is in 1 Corinthians 11. We'll start reading here in verse 2. It says, "Now I praise you, brethren, that you remember me in all things and keep the traditions as I have delivered them to you. But I want you to know that the head of every man is Christ, and the head of woman is man, and the head of Christ is God." Now, pay attention to the word head as we read through the next couple of verses here. As you can tell here in verse 3, that the way the word head has been used, you know, the obvious meaning is one having authority. You know, because it refers to, you know, the head of Christ is God. You know, the head of a man is Christ. You know, and such. Well, it's referring to one who has authority over is what it's referring to. But now we're going to notice as we read through the rest of these verses here, it's also going to start using the word head to refer to our physical head, you know, the part of a body, of human anatomy. And there's going to be sentences where it uses it both ways, you know, where we have the word head, but one time it's used as, you know, the part of our anatomy, and the other is, you know, time it's used as one having authority. And that's key to understanding what's being said here. So let's pick up in verse 4. Every man praying or prophesying, having his head covered, dishonors his head. Now, as we're going to see here as we read through this, you know, these verses, when it's referring to a head being covered, it's talking about hair length. You know, it's getting at the basic, you know, point of nature that men are, you know, intended to have short hair, you know, more masculine look, and women are intended to have long hair to have a feminine demeanor to them. In fact, you know, these verses are going to even tell us a woman having longer hair is a sign of submission, you know, that God designed for the roles between men and women. But notice here when it's talking about a man doing this with his head covered, he's talking about a man having long hair, you know, inappropriate long hair. But it's using the word head here in two different ways. Because it's referring to, you know, if his head is covered, you know, his physical anatomy, you know, his cranium, you know, if his hair is you know, inappropriately long, he's dishonoring his head. Well, the previous verse referred to his head as Christ. You know, so that's who it's referring to, is who he is dishonoring. Now notice verse 5. But every woman who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head. For this is one and the same as if her head were shaved. And notice it being shaved, again, it's referring to a woman not having, you know, appropriately longer hair. You know, again, there's no exact measurement that the Bible gives us, but it's the basic idea that, you know, women have longer hair, have a feminine, you know, demeanor to them, where men have much shorter hair, it's a more masculine look. But it's referring to here that if a woman has inappropriately short hair, she's dishonoring her head. It's referring to her husband, you know, is what it's referring to here. Now continue in verse 6. For if a woman is not covered, let her also be shorn. But if it is shameful for a woman to be shorn or shaved, let her be covered. Again, notice we're referring to hair length. For a man indeed ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God, but the woman is the glory of man. For man is not from woman, but woman from man. Nor was man created for woman, but woman for man. For this reason, a woman ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels. Nevertheless, neither is man independent of woman, nor woman independent of man in the Lord. For as a woman is from a man, even so a man is also through the woman, but all things from God. Judge among yourselves that it is proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered. Does not even nature itself teach you that if a man has long hair, it is a dishonor to him? But if a woman has long hair, it is a glory to her, for her hair is given to her for a covering. For if anyone seems to be contentious, we have no such custom, nor do the churches of God. Now, just in reference to verse 16 there, notice he talks about people being contentious. Now, if you just make a general observation of people that you've known throughout your life, and again, this is kind of a general a truism I've noticed. Now, again, it's not going to apply in every single case. But if you notice kind of the behavior of women, for example, that you see in our culture today, if they have just, you know, really short kind of, you know, butch masculine, you know, type of hairdo that doesn't look feminine at all, what do you tend to find, you know, more often than not in terms of their personality? They're kind of contentious, combative in individuals. They're people who kind of sow discord, you know, wherever they go. Where similar is kind of true of men who have, you know, kind of a long-haired, you know, feminine, you know, hippie kind of style to them. They tend to be, you know, people who just rebel against authority, you know, all authority in general, whether it's legitimate or not, who are just more contentious and want to kind of stir up trouble. You know, he's basically saying here in verse 16, he's kind of pointing out this kind of generality among people. When we defy those basic standards that God has put into very nature, it's kind of rebellion and contention. But now, another thing I'd just like to clarify about this, because if you notice as we read through this, in both cases when it referred to men and to women, it talked about praying and prophesying. Now, typically when we hear the word prophesying in English, we think about foretelling the future. And again, the Greek word here that's translated into English as prophesying can have that meaning, but it can also have a broader meaning as well. And I think it's important to understand that, to fully grasp what these verses are referring to here. Because it's not just specifically talking about someone who's prophesying and foretelling the future. Notice it mentioned praying or prophesying. You know, praying is obviously, you know, an act. Typically, it's a very private thing that, you know, that we do in our own homes, away from anyone else, and it's just a conversation between ourselves and God. Well, let's also notice here that the meaning of the word here, the Greek word that's translated as prophesying in English, because we're going to see here it has a little broader meaning than how we typically oftentimes think of this word. Now, the word here is transliterated into English is prophetio. It's prophetio. It's Strong's number 4395. And the definition I'm going to give you comes from the Complete Word Study Dictionary of the New Testament by Spyros Hayates. Now, I'm only going to read some excerpts from his definition because it's a lot longer than this. But what I want you to see is that it includes, you know, how what we typically think of as prophesying, you know, it's foretelling the future in advance. That is included in the definition, but it has other meanings as well. And here's just some excerpts from Hayates. It says, quote, "To foretell things to come, to declare truth through inspiration of God's Holy Spirit, whether by prediction or otherwise, to tell forth God's message." In other words, this can just be relaying spiritual knowledge, you know, is what this can refer to. It doesn't have to mean, now again, the word does include the meaning of prophesying as we typically think of it. It can also mean just sharing, you know, biblical understanding. And to give you an example of this, turn over to Acts chapter 18. We're going to see here an example that includes a lady that is mentioned in the New Testament several times and spoken of, you know, very highly. This is in Acts chapter 18 and verse 24. Said, "Now a certain Jew named Apollos, born at Alexandria, an eloquent man and mighty in the scriptures, came to Ephesus. And this man had been instructed in the way of the Lord, being fervent in spirit. He spoke and taught accurately the things of the Lord, though he only knew the baptism of John. So he began to speak boldly in the synagogue. Then Aquila and Priscilla heard him. And they took him aside and explained to him the way of God more accurately. And when he desired to cross to Achaia, the brethren wrote exhorting the disciples to receive him. And when he arrived, he greatly helped those who had believed through grace. And he vigorously refuted the Jews publicly, showing from the scriptures that Jesus is the Christ." Now, obviously, the focus here is this guy named Apollos. But notice how Aquila and Priscilla pull him aside and share, you know, more understanding with him that Apollos doesn't have at that point. Now, Aquila and Priscilla are a married couple that are mentioned in the New Testament several times. You know, they're mentioned several times throughout Acts 18. They're also mentioned in a couple of Paul's epistles. You know, and he refers to them, you know, very highly of how he speaks to them. Now, Aquila's the guy; Priscilla is his wife. But notice they pull him aside here, and it doesn't say that just Aquila, you know, kind of brought Apollos up to speed on things he didn't understand. It says Priscilla is involved as well. You know, it very much described her as an active role. Now, again, she's not up in the synagogue giving a sermon, you know, and preaching to everyone. She's not declaring herself as an elder, but she obviously is involved in this. She has insights and understanding she can share with Apollos that he doesn't have. You know, my point here is, you know, just because the Bible says, you know, that women shouldn't have a formal teaching role and have authority over men, you know, like being in a role in the ministry or teaching in services, doesn't mean that the Bible is just telling women to sit down and shut up and, you know, never share their opinion, you know, never having a valuable thought. That's not true at all. That is not how the Bible depicts this. You know, it just defines for us that there are roles that God has defined for men. There's roles he's defined for women. And again, anyone overstepping the bounds of their role is violating God's instructions. We all just, you know, have to accept those limitations. You know, and also realizing, just like with Moses and with Miriam, you know, typically, you know, roles that come with, you might say, more rights or privileges, also come with responsibilities, you know, with a downside, you know, just like with Moses, where he got to take all the criticism, you know, of the Israelites as well. So, and just to share with you a personal example of this, you know, that I clearly see that, you know, the women can have very valuable insights as well. A couple of years ago, I did a sermon on the famine of the word, you know, that's mentioned in Amos chapter 8. And one of the point I made with that sermon is, you know, throughout my lifetime growing up in the Church of God, you know, the perspective on that reference there in Amos chapter 8 was the famine of the word was a famine of preaching God's word. You know, no one would be proclaiming it, you know, at the end time. You know, but that's not what the verse actually says. It says it's a famine of the hearing of the word. Well, I had grown up for most of my life just assuming what I had been taught from childhood, you know, was correct, that's referring to a time when it would never be preached. Well, several years prior to when I gave that sermon, I was giving a sermon, you know, I was visiting a congregation up in Illinois several years ago, and I was speaking on the day of Pentecost. And the subject of my sermon that day was how the Holy Spirit, you know, gives us, you know, spiritually the eyes to see, the ears to hear. You know, in other words, you know, the ability to understand spiritual knowledge. You know, and I wasn't thinking about the book of Amos at all, but right after I concluded services that day and finished my sermon, there was an elderly widow lady in the congregation that came up to me and started, you know, started a conversation with me. And she pointed out to me, she goes, James, have you ever noticed that verse in Amos that we always talk about, the famine of the word? It doesn't say the preaching of the word, it says the hearing of the word. You know, maybe that's, you know, has the same meaning of what you just addressed today. That thought had never crossed my mind until she said that. I mean, I could feel my reaction. I look like one of those characters in the cartoons, you know, when something shocking happens and their jaw, you know, pops down, their mouth's open and their eyes bug out. You know, I could feel myself responding like that because it had never occurred to me until she pointed it out. Well, that ultimately resulted in me studying the subject and giving a sermon on it. My point, you know, being that, you know, God gives his Holy Spirit to women as well, and they can have very, you know, valuable insights to God's word as well. He's just defined, you know, spiritual roles, again, with designated criteria, again, just like he did in ancient Israel, again, with the priesthood being not just men, being the descendants of Aaron. You know, and that's just something we should respect. Well, brothers, I've mentioned today, you know, God has defined a lot of roles of spiritual leadership. Again, they're not always defined by gender. Sometimes they're defined by lineages or, you know, a variety of criteria. And it's something we should just appreciate as far as God's design. Because God uses men and women, you know, as he sees fit, and has placed us all in different roles. And what we should focus on is fulfilling whatever role that God has given us, you know, and doing that to the best of our ability.